Welcome to the Great Books Podcast. Today we'll talk about The Prime of Miss Jean Brody by Muriel Spark. I'm your host, John J. Miller of National Review, and you're listening to a production of National Review. Our guest is Christopher Scalia, a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, and he's podcasted with us previously on Ivanhoe by Sir Walter Scott and Scoop by Evelyn Waugh. He joins us by phone as we record from Hillsdale College's campus radio station WRFH in Michigan. Chris, welcome back to the Great Books Podcast.
Thank you, John. It's great to be back.
Why is The Prime of Miss Jean Brody by Muriel Spark a great book?
I would point to two primary reasons. First would be its memorable characters, especially the title character, Jean Brody, who is a fascinating combination of wisdom and self-delusion, earnestness and manipulation. She really is an unforgettable character and a complicated character who is sometimes likable and then sometimes very, very, very unlikable. And along these lines, I think her relationship with her students is really what makes this such a great and fascinating book, particularly her relationship with Sandy Stranger, who is kind of the central student over the course of the novel. And then secondly, I would say that its remarkable style makes this a great novel. Spark was a master of short novels. She wrote 22 novels, and only one of them was over 250 pages. So she's just kind of the master of elegant, concise works of long-ish fiction, but she also has a very repetitive and spellbinding style that's really enchanting, along with a dark humor in all of her novels, but especially in this one, and a real edge to her narrator. And then another really important part of her style here is the non-sequential structure. She bounces around in her timeline. It's very tricky to do. It can be challenging to the reader to keep up with what is going on when and where in the timeline you are. But Spark does it masterfully. And I think it really makes this, it's one of the reasons it's such an outstanding and memorable work.
We'll talk about all that, the title character, the full cast of characters, the story in this book, her narrative style, also the 1969 movie starring Maggie Smith, the Dowager Countess from Downton Abbey, and a lot more. But Chris, let's start with this title character, Miss Jean Brody. The book is called The Prime of Miss Jean Brody. Tell us a little bit more about her and what is her prime? What does that mean?
The question of her prime is really interesting, and we'll get to that. Brody is a girl school teacher in Edinburgh. She basically teaches what we would call elementary school students. We first encounter her, she's teaching a group of 10-year-old girls. And she's a bit of an iconoclast in that she rebels against her school's administration and really goes off the curriculum. She's supposed to teach certain things, certain subject matters, and she doesn't. I guess you could compare her to Robin Williams' character in Dead Poets Society. Maybe that might be a subject for another term paper. And she is likable. I mentioned before that she's a complicated character because she's so likable in some ways. And I think one of the ways she's especially likable is that she focuses on her teaching. She elevates teaching beauty and the arts to her students. She understands that sometimes it is important to go beyond the curriculum, but there's a downside to this too, in that often her teaching just becomes about herself. She talks a lot about her personal life. She has students over for meals at her house, which is a great thing for a teacher at a small school to do, but they tend to gossip in those instances. She kind of establishes rivalries between the girls. She's very manipulative of them. So she's a complicated mixture of good traits, positive traits, and negative traits. As I mentioned, she wants to dictate the direction of her students, kind of ordain the directions of their studies and their personal lives, which leads to trouble for her over the course of the novel.
What is her prime then from the title, The Prime of Miss Jean Brody?
I think you can understand that title in a straight way and in an ironic way. Taken straight, she's in her prime. This is the prime of Miss Jean Brody because she's a relatively young woman. She's in her 40s over the course of the novel. So John, you and I would agree that is quite young. definitely the prime of one's life. She's not married, so she's independent. She's very smart. and she has a sort of influence. She has a group of students who really look up to her, and she can shape their lives. On the other hand, I think you can read the title ironically in that she's not married. She's middle-aged, so she's basically a spinster. And there were many women like that at this point. This is set in the 1930s, given how many young English men died, or in this case, Scottish men died during World War One. One can see how, there would be a lot of spinsters then, single women of that age. She's eccentric, and she's much less influential and consequential than she really believes, as it becomes clear over the course of the novel. The students do not go in the directions she plans for them and sees for them, and they often kind of sometimes forget about her after her initial influence on them. So the Prime of Miss Jean Brody is itself an ambiguous title, which is, I think, in keeping with so much of the ambiguity you encounter over the course of the novel.
She forms strong bonds with a number of her students. There are six in particular. They're all female. This is a girls' school that she teaches at. They call themselves the Brody Set. Who are these kids?
These are girls we first meet when they're 10 years old, and we really get to know them over the course of 6 years, their time at this school. And Brody is their teacher for much of that time. Brody calls them the creme de la creme, and she is eager to mold and shape these students, as I said. And the most important one of those students I mentioned before is Sandy Stranger. Spark wasn't always subtle with her naming, and Sandy Stranger, as the name implies, is kind of sees herself as a little bit of a misfit, a little bit detached from the group, and skeptical, as the novel proceeds, of Brody's influence on the set and herself in particular. She's untrustworthy. The narrator always points out that Sandy has beady eyes, and so that's never a positive. So there's always something a little bit untrustworthy and even hypocritical about Sandy. We find out early on that she's converted to Catholicism. One of the mysteries of the novel is why she converted to Catholicism, and we know that she's a nun by the end of the novel.
This gets to that point you made earlier about the timeline that bounces around, because she's often projecting, not just with flashbacks, she's projecting into the future and telling us what lies in store for these children when they become adults.
Spark is the master of flash forwards, very quick looks into the future. And a really important version of this, or instance of this, in The Prime of Miss Jean Brody is that we find out pretty early in the novel that somebody betrays Brody. This is a spoiler. We find out early on that it's Sandy, thus her untrustworthiness. But we don't know why Sandy does that until very late in the novel. But this is obviously, that's what makes Sandy such an important character. A lot of the other girls are just kind of, none of them are as fleshed out as Sandy is. But another important one is Mary McGregor, who is the ultimate misfit in the group and is kind of a scapegoat for the group. Everybody likes picking on her, especially Sandy. And we see Brody's ability to manipulate her students in how she kind of gets everybody, and again, especially Sandy, to gang up on Mary McGregor. And in the second chapter, we get a flash forward to how Mary McGregor dies. And it's a really terrible death, but it's also depicted by Spark's very darkly humored narrator in a very funny way, I think. But as she meets her death, Mary McGregor remembers her days in Miss Jean Brody's class and thinks of them as the happiest of her life. And it's very pathetic, because we know that she was so mistreated in that class and was not liked very much by Brody or Sandy Stranger.
Mary's a sad figure. Spark describes her as, quote, a nobody whom everybody could blame, unquote, which is a great line, but also a sad line.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, these six students who make up the Brody Set, should we think of them as teachers' pets? Is that what they are, or is it more complicated than that?
I think people on the outside would see them as teachers' pets. The people who were not in the Brody Set would probably have seen them that way. But because Brody has such grand designs for them, the fact that she latches onto them suggests that they are teachers' pets, but she manipulates them in a cynical way that complicates the relationship a bit more than that. To give you one example, Rose Stanley, another member of this set, is famous for sex, is the phrase that the narrator uses over the course of the novel. And so when we encounter that phrase early in the novel, we think, okay, then she's going to be kind of a promiscuous young girl as she gets older. But that's not really what happens. It turns out what that means is that Miss Jean Brody sees her as kind of an independent, free spirit who she wants to live vicariously through Rose Stanley and tries to set her up with a male teacher at the school that Miss Brody herself once had an affair with. So I think that weird sort of manipulation complicates these relationships to something just beyond kind of the typical teacher's pet relationship.
So you mentioned there's a love interest. There are a couple of love interests for Miss Jean Brody, of course. So there are more characters than just the teacher and the students. There are several other teachers from the school characters. Give us a quick rundown of who are they and how do they interact with Miss Jean Brody, and how do the kids get involved in all that?
So there are the two men. She has love affairs with two men in the school. One is Lloyd, who's the art teacher, a one-armed art teacher. He's kind of glamorous, and the girls like concocting kind of fantasies and fictions about the relationship they have. But Lloyd is married. He's Catholic, and he has many kids, and he's married. So that relationship doesn't last, though Lloyd does go on to have an affair with somebody else in the novel. I won't give that away. And then there's a music teacher named Lowther with whom she has an affair. It's much less exciting, though it gets her in a little bit of trouble. And then there's the administration and her other teachers. Brody is kind of, I mentioned she's an iconoclast, and she's a rebel in her school. She does not really have many other, she's not friends with her colleagues. And so the administration from the beginning is kind of keeping an eye on her, the headmistress in particular, keeping an eye out for her, looking for an excuse basically to fire her. And as I mentioned, we know early on that somebody, Sandy, betrays Jean Brody. And she does that by basically giving the headmistress a good reason to fire Jean Brody.
And this gets into some of the politics of the age. The book is set in 1930s Edinburgh, so Scotland, part of Great Britain. And there's a theme of fascism in the book. Help us understand what that's doing there.
Brody is a lover of all things Italian, especially the arts, but also fascism and Mussolini. And she sees her students as her little fascisti. She calls them that. She loves the order of fascism. She doesn't quite put it this way, but it's almost as if she sees it as an art form in and of itself. I should say she loves all things Italian. She does not actually love Roman Catholicism, which is another important point in the novel. And that connects to the role of fascism in the 1930s. You know, there was a fascistic movement, a British Union of Fascists in that time, led by Sir Oswald Mosley, who was the model, as I'm sure you know, for Roderick Spode of Woodhouse's Burney and Worcester series. Spark doesn't mention him directly, but it's clear that she's kind of playing into the role that fascism played in British politics during the 1930s. To her credit, Brody, at the end of the novel, recognizes that perhaps her enthusiasm for fascism was misplaced, though maybe she doesn't realize the extent to it. She says, I suppose Hitler was rather naughty. That's the most she can say about that. But it has enormous consequences for her students because she basically proselytizes for fascists, and particularly, I mentioned Mussolini, but also for Franco in Spain, and encourages a student to go to Spain to fight for Franco. One of the important factors in the novel is that her enthusiasm for fascism goes too far, and it's what leads to her firing.
You're listening to the Great Books Podcast, a production of National Review, and it's time to dust off your tuxedo or ball gown. Please join National Review Institute on September 29th at the Ronald Reagan Presidential Library in Simi Valley, California, for the 9th annual William F. Buckley Jr. Prize Dinner. This year's gala will honor Larry Kudlow with the Buckley Prize for Leadership and Political Thought and Young America's Foundation with the Buckley Prize for Leadership and Supporting Liberty. We hope you will join NRI for this special black tie affair celebrating Bill Buckley's legacy, the National Review mission, and our esteemed honorees. Limited tickets and sponsorships are available. All proceeds go to support NRI's educational and outreach programs that advance the principles of a free society. RSVP online at nrinstitute.org. That's nrinstitute.org. We hope to see you there. The views and opinions expressed by National Review Institute are not necessarily those shared by the Ronald Reagan Presidential Library and Foundation. Chris, let's go back to this question of betrayal, because it does touch on this matter of fascism that you just discussed. What happens? Why does Sandy betray Miss Jean Brodie, and how does she do it?
There really are two mysteries to the novel, as I said before. One, who betrays her, and that's revealed quickly. Then the second one is why Sandy betrays Brodie. And the way I was just describing it makes it seem as if she betrays her for leading students towards fascism. But that's really just what she goes to the administration about. There's also plenty of evidence to believe that Sandy is jealous of Brodie. They both have an affair with Teddy Lloyd. And Sandy seems convinced that Lloyd is still obsessed with Brodie. Spark is so masterful in creating this ambiguity, because it's never really clear whether this obsession, whether Lloyd is really obsessed or whether it's Sandy's own obsession with Brodie that she's projecting onto Teddy. But regardless, I think it's arguable that it's not the fascism that bothers Sandy, but it's the jealousy over Teddy Lloyd and the frustration, kind of the rivalry there, that makes her turn to the administration and betray Brodie. But even that term, betrayal, Sandy takes issue with it. She says a couple of times in the novel that this issue comes up, whether it's really betrayal, whether what she does is betraying Jean Brodie. She says towards the end of the novel, it's only possible to betray where loyalty is due. So the question is really, how much loyalty is due to Brodie? And I think that's an important question that the reader is left with. She does shape these students, but how much of that formation is actually positive, and therefore the cause of loyalty?
Is she a Judas figure? And I ask that question because she's a betrayer, but also mm-hmm. because this is a novel full of religion and Christianity and different kinds of it. But yeah. Our minds go there, don't they?
They do. I think Brodie is, she doesn't quite reach Jesus levels of moral purity. I'll put it that way. She's a deeply flawed character. Most readers would recognize those flaws and kind of the pernicious influence she has on students. Whatever the reason for Sandy's betrayal is, I think that pure loyalty is not due to Brodie. I think that's a reasonable conclusion. So I wouldn't quite put her on the level. She's not kind of a pure Judas figure. But as far as religion in the novel goes, I mentioned that Sandy becomes a nun, and you don't really know how comfortable she is as a nun. There's an image that recurs over the course of the novel where she publishes a bestseller when she's a nun, and so she's allowed to have visitors talk about the book and other things. And whenever people visit her, she seems deeply uncomfortable. She's gripping the grill of her cell, and you don't know why she's gripping it. Is it because she's uncomfortable speaking to these people? Is it because she's uncomfortable in her her vocation? We just don't know. But then also, Calvinism plays a really important role in the novel as well. Brodie is kind of a, Sandy comes to recognize Brody as the god of Calvinism, somebody who is manipulating everybody, who sees the beginning and the end of all things. And of course, that's how Brody sees herself, but we know that's not actually the case. She tries to preordain the fates of her students, and it doesn't work out that way. On the other hand, I think it's one of the fascinating things of this novel is that the narrator operates as a god of Calvin, the god of Calvin. We've talked about how Spark plays with flash forwards and flashbacks, and the narrator is also omniscient. And so in those ways, it's almost a Calvinistic god where everything is predestined from the beginning of the novel, and the narrator knows all of these fates but is also kind of sinister. Sandy has a very dark view of Calvinism, and she calls it a cruel joke that everybody once believed. And so to her, this Calvinistic belief fits the view of Calvinism that Sandy has fits the role of the narrator and the dark humor I've been describing, because the narrator loves playing with these characters and, you know, killing them off suddenly or frustrating their ambitions.
Behind the narrator, of course, is the author, and that's Muriel Spark, born 1918, died 2006. And there's an interesting religious story there with her. She's one of the famous literary converts in the UK to Roman Catholicism. How does that play into this book? Does it? Is this a Catholic novel?
Spark is never put in this, or rarely put in the same conversation as Evelyn Waugh or Graham Greene, for example. That's always frustrated me a little bit, because you're right, she is part of that great tradition of incredible writers who converted to Roman Catholicism. Her early novels are very Catholic novels. Catholicism always had a place in really all of her novels, or, you know, 90% of them, but it's especially prominent in her early ones. She credited her ability to actually write novels to her conversion to Catholicism. It kind of gave her, she said that she didn't really understand the world in full until she converted to Catholicism. So many of her early novels explore conversion experiences and what inspired those conversions. So we see some of that in this novel, where we kind of get a sense of what could have led Sandy to her conversion. And then in her previous novel, The Girls of Slender Means, which is, I think, it's one of my favorites, probably my favorite Spark novel. That's also largely about what inspired somebody to convert to Catholicism and become a missionary. Again, those questions and those concerns tail off a little bit towards the end of Spark's career, but her early novels are really preoccupied with those questions. And, you know, and as far as kind of the broader climate of Catholicism and all of the conversions of these great writers, Spark said that she never really had basically a road to Damascus moment where she suddenly saw everything clearly. For her, it was just reading about the church, and especially reading the works of John Henry Newman, and recognizing that she just saw the world the same way. It just made sense that the way Newman and the church understood the world was how she had understood the world. So it's not the same sort of conversion experience that, say, Waugh had, where in large part it was just kind of going to Catholicism because it was a bulwark of civilization and partly kind of a reaction against the modern world.
This novel, The Prime of Miss Jean Brody, was made into a movie in 1969, starring Maggie Smith, who I know as the Dowager Countess on Downton Abbey. This was early in her career, obviously. She won the Academy Award for Best Actress. Is the movie any good, Chris?
The movie is good. It takes liberties with the novel, so if you're a purist and don't want to see any changes made, you'll be dissatisfied. But it is a very good movie, and it's certainly worth watching. One of the interesting things about the movie is that it was produced in the late 60s. You know, a different political climate than in 1961 when Spark first published the novel. By the way, the novel was originally published in a single issue of The New Yorker, to give you a sense of how relatively short it was. So in the late 60s, with this different political climate, the producers take some liberties and make some additions, especially with the dialogue, to subtly address some of the political turmoil of the late 60s. There is also, and from the late 70s, a TV miniseries based on the novel. That should be avoided. It is very loosely based on the novel. It doesn't convey any of the complexity of Brody herself. It's there's one episode in particular where they introduce some new characters, and one of them is a political refugee from Italy who's escaping Mussolini, and he talks to Miss Jean Brody about the dangers of fascism. And after that episode, there are no longer any posters of Mussolini in her classroom. It's just kind of an overly sanitized version of the novel.
So read the book, see the movie, skip the TV show. Chris, how did you discover Muriel Spark and this book?
It's funny. All of the novels I've talked to you about on this podcast, Ivanhoe, Scoop, and The Prime of Miss Jean Brody, were introduced to me directly or indirectly by Robert McCubbin, who was an English professor at the College of William and Mary, took a number of classes with. I guess you could call him my own Jean Brody, though he had a much more purely positive influence on me. But I took a Scottish literature course with him my senior year, and that's where I first read Walter Scott, and it's where I first read this novel. I was immediately hypnotized by it. But I didn't read anything else by Spark until like 13 years later. I went on a big Spark kick, and I read The Girls of Slender Means, Memento Mori, and since then I've read all of her novels. I owe it to a singular professor who had a great influence on me. He died a couple of years ago, but yeah, I will always be grateful to what I learned from him and the directions his teaching led me.
Final question. This book always shows up on lists of best 100 novels of the 20th century. Published in 1961, that's more than 60 years ago. What's the case for reading it now in the 2020s?
I think any reader going into it will, recognize that in some ways the setting is very dated. It's the 1930s. So the school setting is unlike what most readers will be familiar with. That's an easy thing to overcome. So many elements of the novel are contemporary. The style in particular, I've said that it can be challenging to the reader, but it's not too challenging. We're not talking about Ulysses here. And it's almost, I would say, almost postmodern in the way she plays with the chronology and with time. The humor of the novel, the style of the novel, and just kind of the spellbinding, enchanting qualities of Spark's writing ensure that it really does hold up despite it being set almost 100 years ago. I think some of the issues that we've been discussing, the religious issues, the political issues, are enduring issues and raise enduring questions, but especially the role of education and of teachers. I mean, we've seen this over the last couple of years in the United States, what the role of teachers are and what independence teachers should have. I think Brody's kind of a figure from a modern classroom who maybe oversteps the bounds in the influence that she tries to have on her students. So I think that those questions make it certainly worth reading in the 2020s.
Chris Scalia, thanks so much for joining us and telling us all about The Prime of Miss Jean Brody by Muriel Spark.
You're very welcome, John. Thank you very much for having me back on.
You've just listened to The Great Books Podcast, a production of National Review. Please subscribe to The Great Books Podcast and leave reviews of the show. That helps us keep this podcast going. Send me your ideas for future episodes. You can reach me through my website at heymiller.com. On Twitter, my handle is at heymiller. Last fall, special thanks to all of you for listening. We'll be back next week with a new episode of The Great Books Podcast.